This is VOA News. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil. There is lots of reaction worldwide and of course in the United States after former U.S. police officer Derek Chauvin was found guilty of all charges, including murder and the death of George Floyd. The black man died in police custody with Chauvin's knee on his neck almost a year ago. A video of the arrests led to protests not just in the United States, but again around the world over racism and police. The city of Minneapolis, Minnesota is now seeing celebrations continue instead of violent, feared by a not guilty verdict. There's high security in several places. A guilty verdict came after about just 10 hours of jury deliberations over 2 days. Chauvin's expected to appeal and faces decades in prison. U.S. President Joe Biden made nationally televised remarks calling the guilty verdict a rare but giant step forward in the march toward justice in America. The president earlier told the family of George Floyd how relieved he was in a phone call after the jury found the former officer guilty. The White House says the president, First Lady, and Vice President Kamala Harris watched the jury's decision live on television near the president's Oval Office. A witness in Chad tells Reuters streets in the country's capital were emptying as people grew alarmed at the prospect that fighting could break out after the news of President Idris Deby's death. The president, who ruled his country for more than 30 years and was an important Western ally, was killed Monday in a battle against rebels, according to the military. His son was named interim president by a transitional council of military officers. This is VOA News. Russian President Vladimir Putin is delivering a State of the Nation speech to Russians on Wednesday as supporters of his critic Alexei Navalny plan nationwide protests. Supporters of the 44-year-old Navalny say he is in poor health after a 3-week hunger strike. Past rallies in support of Navalny have been broken up by force, with thousands of arrests, and authorities now say Wednesday's gathering will be illegal. Navalny survived a poisoning last year that Russia denies carrying out and was sentenced to 2 years in jail after he returned. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky on Tuesday invited his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, to meet in Ukraine's war-torn east. Tensions remain high in recent fights and have intensified between Ukraine's army and pro-Russian separatists, a long-running conflict. Russia is accused of amassing thousands of troops at the Ukrainian border. The European Union estimates the number of Russian troops at more than 100,000. Libya says the flights between Tripoli and Cairo will restart on Wednesday after more than 6 years. Libya's prime minister also announced the Egyptian embassy will reopen soon. Egypt closed its Tripoli embassy and halted flights in 2014 during conflicts between rival governments. Blood clots should be listed as a very rare side effect of the Johnson & Johnson coronavirus vaccine, but its benefits still outweigh the risks. That's according to the EU's drug watchdog Tuesday. The European Medicines Agency said in a statement that it found a possible link between the vaccine and clots following 8 such cases in the United States, one of which was fatal. Concerns over the vaccine by U.S. pharmaceutical giant Johnson & Johnson and the shot by rival drug maker AstraZeneca have dampened hopes that vaccines could offer a swift end to the pandemic. Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador again received the AstraZeneca vaccine against COVID-19 at his regular daily news conference. The 67-year-old who had contracted the coronavirus in January said that he wanted to encourage all older adults to also get vaccinated. There is more at voanews.com via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Wednesday, April 21st. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Chadians mourn the death of President Idriss Deby.
President Deby went to the field because the morale of the soldier was very, very down. And he was obliged to go to the field to give hope to the soldiers.
UN Secretary General is saddened by the death of Chad's president. Human Rights Watch condemns extrajudicial killings in Mali. Burundi's government welcomes its improved ratings on the Media Freedom Index. Ramadan gatherings continue in Tanzania amid COVID-19. And there was a brawl Tuesday in Sierra Leone's parliament.
A proclamation was read. However, members of the opposition party, we are not happy about that. They rushed at the speaker, assaulted him, and they turned the proclamation signed by His Excellency yesterday.
And Malawi president proposes a switch from growing tobacco. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Chadians are mourning the death of President Idriss Deby, who passed away Monday at age 68. Deby seized power in 1990 and has ruled Chad for more than 30 years. He had been an ally of the West in the fight against Islamist militants in the Sahel. The circumstances surrounding his death are not yet clear, but reports say he was killed Monday in a battle against the rebels. A transitional military council has chosen Deby's son, Mohamed Idriss Deby, as head of the council. The United States has expressed sorrow for Deby's death and hopes for a peaceful transition of power in accordance with Chad's constitution. Clement Abayifuta is president of the Association of Victims of former Chadian President Issen Habré's crimes.
President Deby, according to what is saying through media, he died early this morning. From his wound, he went to the field because the morale of the soldier was very, very down. And he was obliged to go to the field to give hope to the soldiers.
How common is it that the president of the country will be on the battlefield?
As you said, Idriss Deby is a soldier, so a soldier, what he knew to do very well is war as a good soldier.
What are Chadians saying about the death of their president?
Some of his partisans is very down, and most of the people, they say that he had many opportunities to do well and to suggest some negotiation, but as he refused, and he obliged himself to be elected because the election was not very free.
President Deby was just re-elected this week. Now we hear that the military has formed a council to be led by President Deby's son. What is the reaction in Chad about this?
You know, two figures of opposition said that they didn't agree with this military council because they had said through a letter that they wrote yesterday that is not the hope of the people, because the people want a large consultation and include the people's needs.
What do you think the death of President Deby mean now for the fight against the Islamists or the insurgents in Chad?
I think that is another page that we turn, as is president of our country is we turn and we focus in the future of country. I don't know that Islamic will rejoice because he is a man who fight them, he deal with them. For them, it is he rejoice. But I think that if it is your enemy, you cannot appreciate his death, because death is death. So my concern is, it is a Chadian, it is a man, a human being. He dead, so everyone is called to death, though. I don't know exactly what I can say, but I think that it is sorry for the country because he's a son of our country.
Clement Abaifuta is the president of the Association of Victims of former Chadian President Hissène Habré's crimes. He was speaking with us from the Chadian capital, N'Djamena. A spokesperson for UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres says the Secretary General is deeply saddened by the death of Chadian President Idriss Déby. Stéphane Dujarric says the UN will continue to provide humanitarian support to Chad. He calls on the international community to continue to support the effort.
I can tell you, of course, that the Secretary General is deeply saddened to hear about the passing of President Idriss Déby of Chad this morning. He expresses his deepest condolences to the President's family as well as to the people and the government of Chad. Just to give you some context on the humanitarian situation in Chad, the situation in the country is characterized by growing humanitarian needs linked to the conflict in the Lake Chad Basin, as well as the effects of climate change. We, along with our partners, are continuing our operations in the country to assist impacted communities. The humanitarian response plan for Chad is seeking $617 million this year. To date, it's only 6% funded. We urge the international community to provide financial support to meet the needs of the people in need. And from January to September of last year, just to give you some information, we reached at least 2.2 million people with humanitarian assistance in the country. And Chad is also host to a number of refugee communities as from bordering countries, as you know.
The U.S. embassy has been evacuated a few hours ago, which means that it's going to get bad.
Well, we very much hope it doesn't. It is not going to get bad. I think this is an important moment for Chadians to strengthen national cohesion and to work together for the stability of their country.
As you mentioned, it's a very volatile region. Tell us what the Secretary General has been doing with regard to this since he heard the news of what's happened in Chad, and does he believe the Security Council should now meet?
We'll see what the Security Council decides to do. I know the Secretary General had a conversation earlier today with the chair of the African Union Commission, Mohamed Moussa Faki. He has been kept abreast of the situation, and we're obviously in touch with our colleagues on the ground.
As you know, this follows elections, which were themselves not particularly free and fair. What does the UN think should happen now? I know the situation on the ground is still very fluid, but should there be fresh, free elections now?
Look, there is a constitutional order which should be respected, and I think it's important at this moment for Chadian political leaders to ensure the safety of the population, the stability of the country.
One last one on Chad, if I can, about the UN presence in Chad. Mm-hmm. The borders of the country, according to the US State Department, have now all been closed. The airport's been closed. What is the UN presence in Chad? How concerned are you about the safety of the UN staff in Chad?
The UN presence in Chad is about 1,800 staff, both national and internationals. We obviously rely on the Chadian authorities to ensure the safety and security of our staff. We also are doing our own security assessment, and we're watching the situation hour by hour.
That was Stéphane Dujarric, a spokesperson for UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. Killings and disappearances allegedly committed by Malian security forces need to be addressed with investigations, according to Human Rights Watch. In its recent report, Human Rights Watch highlights events that took place in many areas of Mali. Corinne Dufka, Sahel Director of Human Rights Watch, explains to Ricky Stryak the details of two events that took place in Libby and Boni, where men were allegedly tortured and at least 13 of them are still missing.
The Malian security forces, seemingly out of reprisal after their own forces had been attacked and 9 of them killed in a nearby village of Sakora, attacked the town of Libe, which we understand they accused of harboring the armed Islamists, which involved in the attack against their own forces. So they surrounded that village. They went in. They executed a number of people point blank. They burned others alive. There was one very disturbing incident in which they picked up seven men, elderly men, took them into an abandoned boutique and executed them point blank. So really horrific incidents. They also looted the village, stole valuables from people. And then recently in Boni, they did a routine check of a bus and coming from Bamako. And on that bus, they found a pair of military boots and part of a uniform. And then they took all of the 35 pull men who were on that bus into the military headquarters in Boni and proceeded to blindfold them, tie them, and then severely, severely beat them and burned some of them.
Does this mark a new step toward Malian government forces exercising extrajudicial power? You know, has there been a degradation of the chain of command since the transition within the Malian government?
Well, it's a little early to tell. And I would say every year for the last several years, there have been a few worrying, emblematic incidents like this. So I think it's too early to say whether it really marks a degradation in their behavior. We're calling on the Malian government to open investigations into those incidents, which they haven't opened investigations into, and they did announce investigations opened into the Libe and the Kobu incidents, but it's not the first time they've announced the opening of investigations, and we very often don't see significant, meaningful progress in these investigations.
Are there any additional steps that are being taken or that Human Rights Watch thinks should be taken in order to ensure that these killings and these kind of abuses don't take place in the first place?
You know, the good news is that the Malian government, over the last several years, has routinely opened investigations into the most serious incidents involving their forces. The bad news is these investigations never seem to progress. The families don't know about them. They often don't involve the families. And clearly, the other soldiers don't know about any progress that's made either, because otherwise the investigations would deter further abuses. So clearly, the message is not getting down to the Malian soldiers, you know, officers commanding them that these incidents, should not occur. So we ask them to make progress on investigations, to open investigations into the incidents they haven't, as well as to ensure that the gendarme provost marshals, which are responsible for ensuring the rights of detainees and ensuring discipline during operations, to make sure that they are present in all operations. And lastly, to anticipate these response after soldiers are killed, because we end up seeing a lot of these reprisal-like attacks after major attacks against the Malian security forces.
That was Corinne Dufka, Sahel Director of Human Rights Watch. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Washington, D.C. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, April 21st. There was a brawl Tuesday in Sierra Leone's parliament during the introduction of a presidential order to hold a census in Sierra Leone this year. Members of parliament from the opposition All People's Congress, the APC, objected because they said the process did not follow the proper procedure. They accused President Julius Maada Bio's government of undemocratic tendencies. Param Tarawale is clerk of parliament from the ruling Sierra Leone People's Party, the SLPP. He says the opposition claims are baseless because it is the prerogative of the president to summon parliament to consider an order.
The president of the Republic of Sierra Leone, pursuant to section 86(1) of the Constitution of Sierra Leone, summoned a meeting of parliament to consider the census order. So parliament reconvened to look at the order. A proclamation was read to that effect. However, members of the opposition party, the All People's Congress, we are not happy about that. They rushed at the speaker, assaulted him, and they turned the proclamation signed by His Excellency the President, and then violently disrupted the entire parliamentary sitting.
The opposition is claiming that the introduction of the bill was illegal and it did not follow procedure.
I don't know where they got that claim from, but as far as I'm concerned, any claim that the introduction of that bill is unprocedural seems extremely baseless and of no ground. Because calling parliament, it's the prerogative of His Excellency the President under section 86(1). What they were claiming is that they should have been consulted before calling parliament. And 86(1) of the Constitution is very clear that president may at any time call a meeting of parliament. And that was exactly what the president did. and parliament reconvene. So the legality they are talking about, I will not comment on that because as far as I'm concerned, as clerk of parliament, no law was breached.
Did you say the bill was about the census? And can you tell us what's in the bill?
So by the Census Act of 2002, specifically Section 2 of that act, it gives the president the power, after seeking the advice of the minister, to call for a national census. However, by Section 170, subsection 7 of the Constitution of Sierra Leone, any statutory instrument or constitutional instrument emanating from any order by His Excellency the President or any minister should be laid on the table of Parliament and allow 21 days to mature into law. So that was just what His Excellency the President did. He made the order in form of a constitutional instrument, and it was laid on the table of Parliament by the Attorney General and Minister of Justice. So, and that order speaks to the fact that President, pursuant to Section 2 of the Census Act of 2002, has proclaimed a census throughout Sierra Leone.
When should this census take place?
Well, according to the order which came to Parliament, the census should commence on the 18th day of September 2021.
Honorable Param, thank you very much again. It's so nice talking with you.
You're welcome, John.
Param Tarawale is clerk of Sierra Leone's parliament from the ruling Sierra Leone People's Party, the SLPP. He was speaking with us from Freetown. A spokesperson for Burundi's president says it is about time that international press freedom organizations begin to portray Burundi in the right way when it comes to press freedom. In its 2021 World Press Freedom Index, Reporters Without Borders, also known as RSF, said Burundi and several other African countries significantly raised their scores. Burundi went up by 13 points to 147th because of the government's release last December of four journalists with the independent Iwachu publications. Wele Nyamitwe is chief of the Information and Communication Division of the Burundian State House. He says Burundi has always respected media freedom.
I saw the report from Reporters Without Borders. So this was a good news indeed for Burundi. But it's even a good thing that some organizations start to recognize that the way they have been portraying Burundi in the past was not appropriate. I saw that the assessment on the fact that the four journalists of Iwachu were set free at the end of last year. Let me recall that originally the four journalists were not arrested for the simple fact that they were journalists. Of course, this is not to spark unnecessary debate. But I want the listeners to know that the four persons committed an offense and were prosecuted and tried like any other citizen. So Burundi has always respected the freedom of the media. So it doesn't start today. Remember that when President Evariste Ndayishimiye met journalists and media professionals at the end of January this year, his slogan was, I quote, never without the media, end of quote. Let me say that media freedom is one of the concerns of the president and the government of Burundi.
While your government gets credit for the Iwachu press, if I were Reporters Without Borders, and I'd like for you to respond to this, I would want to hold on before giving you that much credit. On the one hand, you, I think the last time we spoke last month, your government was said to have asked Rwanda to stop Renaissance TV, Radio RPA, and Izamba Radio from broadcasting from Rwanda.
Let me put it again. The freedom of the press is one of the major concerns of the government of Burundi. Coming back to the decision of Rwanda last month to shut down some so-called media houses that became a nest of lies. As I said last month, this was a very good decision, wise decision, And Burundi has welcomed this decision, which was also legitimate. So Reporters Without Borders and all the other organizations that claim to defend freedom of speech should also join all the other voices that are condemning those so-called media houses that have only been propagating lies and hatred using the territory of Rwanda.
Wele Damitwe is the chief of the Information and Communication Division at the Burundian State House. He was speaking with us from the capital, Bujumbura. While many countries with Muslim populations have imposed the coronavirus restrictions during the holy month of Ramadan, Tanzania, which is more than a third Muslim, has not. Despite President Samia Suluhu Hassan's shift away from her predecessor's COVID-19 denial, the new leader has yet to take up measures recommended by global health authorities. Charles Kumbe reports from Dar es Salaam.
Mariam Keringo usually observes the holy month of fasting every year. She's now preparing an evening meal, known in Arabic as iftar, for her family and friends to break the day's fast. Keringo believes that being able to get together during this period, despite the coronavirus pandemic, is lucky. Honestly, we thank God we get an opportunity to join together with relatives in eating iftar, she says. It is different in other countries, Keringo adds, where we hear that the coronavirus has restricted them and they don't get the opportunity to join together during Ramadan. She added that in Tanzania, we hear that the coronavirus is present, but it has not become a big threat to a point that it prohibits us from getting together during Ramadan. The coronavirus pandemic has disrupted social and economic life across the globe. But in Tanzania, everything seems as normal as it used to be, with few people observing social distancing or wearing face masks. Despite the presence of the virus, Muslim leaders say they are continuing to hold prayers and teachings at mosques. Mursalina Ali is an imam at Kichangani Mosque in the city. We have directed all our issues to God, and He helps and protects us against this coronavirus disaster, he says. Ali adds that, regarding religious teachings, they are also going well. There are many people coming in because they fear God, and they need blessings and favors from God. Tanzania stopped counting COVID-19 cases in May of last year, with then-President John Magufuli declaring the country free from the coronavirus. Now, worshippers have different perceptions about the infections. For Mwanahamisi Mohammed, when you put everything to God, there's nothing to worry about. I'm not afraid because I depend on God. Even if I say I'm wearing a face mask, Mohammed added, the virus can infect me because it is brought by God. For Salma James, fears still prevail. We really fear. We fear a lot, but we thank God. We can join together like this Ramadan, she says. Magufuli died last month. 2 weeks ago, Hassan announced the government will form a committee to fight COVID-19. Opposition politicians say Hassan has to fast-track her proposal to form a scientific committee to research the disease, but say her acceptance of the problem is a promising sign. Boniface Jacob is a former mayor of Ubungo. He urged people to take precautions against the disease. He said, to me, these are the indicators that we are headed in a good direction. He added that this is contrary to the previous times of deceiving each other, that the problem was not there, and it disappeared by prayers, as if God was there for Tanzania only. In the meantime, many Muslims, including Keringo, are joining together for prayers and evening meals, unaware of the danger from the coronavirus that remains around them. Charles Kombe, for VOA News, Dar es Salaam, Tanzania.
And that's it for this Wednesday, April 21st edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Barton, Washington, saying, have a great day.